Thank you. Good morning, or good afternoon now. May it please the court. My name is David Teal. I represent the appellant, Mr. Valdez-Lopez. Mr. Valdez-Lopez went to trial and he was convicted on five counts. The fifth count was a 924C enhancement charge for brandishing a firearm. Some 12 years and 20 days later, he was successful in his collateral attack pursuant to 2255. He challenged count five and he was successful. Count five carried with it, as the court knows, a 7-year mandatory sentence consecutive to the counts 1 through 4 sentence. Judge Carroll, the original judge, was in a semi-retirement status, so the case was sent by random lot to Judge Logan. Judge Logan had the magistrate judge consider the matter, and on the 2255, the government did not, or went uncontested. The government conceded the 2255. The magistrate judge agreed, and the matter went to Judge Logan, where he adopted it. This was the triggering event that the Ninth Circuit requires, or a component of the triggering event that the Ninth Circuit appears to require to conduct its reasonable likelihood analysis under Pierce. Judge Logan went to resentencing on counts 1 through 4, and the original sentence was 240 months as imposed by Judge Carroll on counts 1 through 5. Judge Logan on counts 1 through 4 imposed 300 months, a 5-year net increase. And that was without, as I've already indicated, the 7 years that was mandatory consecutive for the enhancement. So the question before this court became, does that invoke the Pierce presumption, the prophylactic rule? Because there's no double jeopardy protection, then we're left with the due process protection.
Are there any facts relevant to sentencing that are different that would justify the increase? Or is this just, we have a different judge who has a different view of the matter?
I shouldn't say no. I don't believe from the record, and in my briefs, I argued that the record does not reveal any new evidence. The court itself, Judge Logan, indicates that he relied upon the record before with Judge Carroll. The record reflects that the sentencing memorandum filed by the government was nearly identical. Government recommendation remained unchanged, and the only new evidence, or potentially new evidence, was that Mr. Valdez-Lopez, some 10 years earlier, just when he had essentially just started his incarceration, was in a fight, and the defense argued that that was a kind of a necessary evil of being incarcerated, and he requested to be transferred, and it never happened again. Near the end of the resentencing, Judge Logan acknowledged that, but in appellant's mind, dismissed that and did not consider it, noting that it was over 10 years old, and it was not a basis for the judge's decision. It wasn't considered new conduct that he relied on in imposing the sentence.
My question is, what legal authority tells us that the Pierce presumption applies in a situation like this where we have two different judges at the sentencing phases?
Right. That's not necessarily an easy question. So I would say that I don't know that there is a case that says it directly applies. I think that the Supreme Court jurisprudence tells us that it does apply. So I think that I took issue with the government's argument that there's a bar when a second judge is the sentencer, a new judge is the sentencer.
So is that what you're asking us to do in this case, to establish that the Pierce presumption applies when we have two different sentencing judges?
I don't think that the court needs to do that. I think that that's all the court needs to do is apply the McCullough and or apply Alabama v. Smith, the reasonable likelihood test, and the Ninth Circuit appears to require a triggering event. And I think we've established there's a triggering event to consider the reasonable likelihood analysis. And so in that situation, the court can consider the fact that there's a second judge. But just like the cases, so let's take Colton or Chafin as an example, where a scholar might argue that those mean that there's not or no longer can you have a second senator sentencers involved when there's a bar. Well, those cases don't stand for that either. In those cases, you have reasonable explanations as to why the court held how it did and why they emphasize that consideration. So for an example, in Colton, it was a two-tier system where it was an automatic de novo new trial. The new court has there's no record before the court that was considered before. There's not the same testimony. They don't know the punishment. None of that's in play. In Chafin, a new jury. Same thing though. The new jury, and the court points all this out, the new jury doesn't know about the punishment. The new jury doesn't have any institutional interests or motivations. There's no triggering event for the jury. So they don't have the same types of things that the court in Pierce would have been concerned with. They're not preoccupied with those things. And if you take a case like McCullough, the court also does not announce a rule, but they do, for example, Judge Brennan, his concurrence discusses the fact that if there was doesn't really categorize it, but he says if there was more evidence of a reasonable likelihood, then he would have agreed that the Pierce presumption should apply. And in that instance, he would have found that the government's excuses or the rebuttal would not have sufficed. And then the
counsel, may I ask, I mean, not only do we have two different judges, but this is also somewhat different from the usual vindictiveness context where, you know, it's not like the sentencing judge got reversed. And so then we might think, well, you know, he's thinking, you know, I'm angry with you for getting me reversed, so I'm going to punish you. Here, the only reason there needed to be a new sentencing was that Judge Logan himself had granted the 2255 motion. So where the resentencer is the same person who created the need for the resentencing, why should we think that a person in that situation would feel vindictiveness towards someone whose motion, you know, he had granted?
Right, Judge. What I've argued is that the 2255 could still serve as a trigger for Judge, in this case, it would happen to be Judge Logan. The reason it could still serve as a trigger or some motivation or some institutional interest might be triggered is because the court did not have broad discretion here. So for example, again, in McCullough, the judge was deciding whether it was prosecutorial misconduct or not. The judge ultimately decided there it was prosecutorial misconduct, and that was something that was it's based on facts and law, but it's the way I argued is it's more discretionary. Here, Judge Logan is handed a 2255 where the government conceded it and the magistrate judge concurred, and the Supreme Court's new case law said this is what it should be. And so Judge Logan then adopted that. But because we do not have to establish actual vindictiveness, we only have to establish a real possibility, then the record itself is what demonstrated that he was punishing Mr. Valdez-Lopez for that successful 2255, for the fact that he no longer had the broad discretion. And what I argued was his authority and his discretion was weaker than what it would normally be because of that 2255. And that is manifested in the comments about his right to go to trial, the questions to the government about whether or not he was offered a plea and who went to trial and what the ultimate sentence was, and those types of things that I outlined in the reply.
Okay, let's hear from the government and you'll get a chance to respond.
Mr. Wu? Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Ray Wu and I'm here to represent the United States. The presumption of vindictiveness does not apply here. The resentencing in this particular matter was handled by a new judge. This judge did not oversee the first trial. This new judge did not impose the original sentence. There's simply nothing.
Can he go back and say, you know, I changed my mind. Would you please not grant my 2255? That was a terrible mistake for me to file a 2255 because it resulted in an extra 5 years of punishment. Thanks a lot for granting the 2255.
Yes, Your Honor.
You would have been better off just staying in jail saying, you know, I was wrongly convicted on that one, but I'm just going to take my medicine. I'm just going to sit here. I'm not going to challenge it. Because it's not for my trouble, for pointing out that I was unjustly convicted on that count, I'm going to get an extra 5 years. Such a deal. I mean, there's something wrong with this. It may not be correctable given our doctrine about vindictive punishment, but they're just this does not seem quite right to me.
Yes, sir. And I think, you know, earlier when you asked a question of Mr. Thiel, I think you made the point that I was going to make, which is this sentence is essentially handled by a different judge with a different view of the matter. Ultimately, there's really no triggering event that would suggest that the court had any reason to self-vindicate. If I may take it a step further, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I think that's right. And the judge sentenced higher than you guys recommended.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. You know, in looking over the record, I would submit to the court, there's really nothing in there to suggest that the court's sentence was the product of actual vindictiveness. There was no triggering event. There's no evidence that the court had a particular bias towards Mr. Valdez-Lopez. There's nothing in the law or nothing in the record to suggest that the court had an institutional motivation to discourage either Mr. Valdez-Lopez or other defendants from going to trial or filing an appeal. This claim of, you know, that there is a presumption of vindictiveness is simply unfounded, and I would ask the court deny it. Now, the question now becomes whether the court abused its discretion when it independently reviewed the record, the pre-sentence report, the sentencing memos, to come up with a sentence that it felt was reasonable. As I stated in my brief, the court did, in fact, provide fact-based reasons, which were logical and non-vindictive, for its sentence. The court focused on the seriousness of the defendant's conduct and the emotional harm caused to, in the court's words, to a staggering number of victims. This was a very serious hostage-taking case involving a large number of victims. There were over 70 people held hostage in a small three-bedroom house. To provide the court some context, those 70 people were held in bedrooms. I think one witness testified that he was in one of the bedrooms with 30 people. They were forced to sit. They weren't allowed to stand. They were starved, and they were threatened with violence. The court focused on that and stated that, you know, in his discretion, he felt that he had to give some consideration to all of these victims. The court also talked about and focused on the defendant's criminal history, which included some prior acts of violence, as well as he considered the circumstances of the co-defendants and the circumstances of this defendant.
Now, the circumstances of the co-defendant are a little tricky here because the co-defendants pleaded and they got lower sentences. But of course, that just happens all the time. The punishment for not taking a plea is you're subjecting yourself to the possibility of guilt and then in a higher sentence. We say that you're not punished for going to trial. And under the doctrine, he's not been punished for going to trial. But in fact, that's exactly what happened.
Yes, Your Honor. I would also say that he was punished for the counts of conviction that the jury found him guilty of.
Oh, no, I understand and I'm not arguing that within the meaning of the doctrine that he's been punished for going to trial, because he clearly is not. This happens every day. You reject a plea that has a light sentence, you go to trial, and you get a heavier sentence. That's just the way it works. I get it.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. So ultimately, you know, Judge Logan found the...
I'm sorry, yes, I'm jumping in again. So shifted to the second issue about whether there was an abuse of discretion for the second judge to come to the sentence that he came to. And you've made the argument that he was looking at the facts and circumstances and he made his decision based on that. And I guess I would maybe assume for purposes of my question that had he been the first judge, that would have been a reasonable sentence to give. My question is, when you're the second judge and a sentence has already been given in a case, when we look at abuse of discretion, is there any legal authority that says that the second judge needs to take into account what the first judge did as part of that exercise of discretion or not?
Your Honor, I don't recall anything specific. I will cite to the court Texas versus McCullough, where the court said that when you have a situation where you have different sentencers assessing the various sentencing a defendant can receive, the second sentence, if it's an increase, cannot truly be said to be an increase because it's essentially a new type of sentence. It's being independently reviewed by a new judge who is exercising its discretion. But to answer your question, I can't think of a particular case to address that other than Texas versus McCullough. So in this particular case, Judge Logan, in his exercise of independence, exercise judicial discretion, reviewed the facts and the factors of 3553 to decide that a 25-year term, which is ultimately far below what the advisory guideline range was, which was life, to be a reasonable one. It was different from what I recommended, but again, there are varying degrees of what would be a reasonable sentence under the advisory guideline range. For all the reasons that I've stated here today, as well as the arguments set forth in the government's brief, I would ask the court affirm the sentence imposed by Judge Logan. Thank you.
Any further questions for the government? Would you put 2 minutes on the clock for response? Mr. Teel?
Thank you, Judge. I think I'll go back to the original, the purpose behind Pierce. And so the purpose is to ensure that when someone collaterally attacks their sentence, that there's no vindictiveness in that that results in, as any part of the sentence. And the second part is to prevent, or hopefully prevent, apprehension in people like Mr. Valdez-Lopez from doing what he did in this case. And so I would argue that there's nothing about a second sentence or a new judge handling a 2255 that would suggest that those concerns are all present. And those concerns would, in fact, deter someone like Mr. Valdez-Lopez, who is presently, if I'm doing my math right, he's presently would have exceeded the sentence. He's already exceeded what he would have been sentenced if the judge had imposed, or if Judge Logan had imposed the original 20-year term. And so that alone, even with the narrowing of Pierce that has happened, there is not an absolute bar to a second judge, and it would be inconsistent with the intent of Pierce.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, both sides. Case of United States versus Valdez-Lopez submitted for decision.
Thank you.